Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to this month's Tragedy and Hope with my excellent co-host, Richard Grove. If you're not familiar with Richard, get over to tragedyandhope.com. There's a live link right here. Rich just posted his 82nd episode, which is absolutely fabulous. So you're going to want to listen to it. So without further ado, let me say good morning to Richard Grove. How are you, Rich?
I'm excellent. Good morning, Maria.
You know, I think I told you a story on somebody else's show last week. It's hard for me to remember. But your name came up, and I talked about how when you came out with your information on 9/11, how the 9/11 community didn't even want to acknowledge it, let alone know about it, until, of course, I played it and burned up my service for 2 weeks, and all of a sudden you were in popular demand. So when you look at 9/11, even today, even till today, there are still people fighting amongst themselves over who has the truth and who doesn't.
Well, what I saw back then was I wasn't aware of all the internet truther research and stuff like that, because most of my research was coming from books, and there was some online research pertaining to 9/11. But basically, I was coming at it from a different perspective. I was looking at it as the problem is that people in America lack the historical context to recognize and avoid lies, and the effect of that is that America's under the influence. You know, call us an Ambien nation or say that Americans have an irony deficiency disorder. And I felt the solution to that would be to start composing media that reflected evidence of, you know, that which exists, that's organized in a solutions-oriented manner.
Mm-hmm. Well, and an excellent job you've done and still continue to do. You know, when you look at America right now, a lot of people, myself included, say we're living in a post 9/11 world, and we really have to have the truth on 9/11 because they've used it to, you know, not only create illegal wars, but also to suppress our freedom. But after listening to your episode 82, is 9/11 all to blame for America today?
Well, you know, one of the reasons after being a whistleblower and continuing to do research that we created tragedyandhope.com and I launched the Peace Revolution podcast was that I was noticing this ominous continuity of a pattern that is recognizable through history, that of the Patriot Act and Homeland Security and TSA. We've seen this go on in countries before in history. What we haven't seen that is unique to our situation is the technocracy and the cybernetics, the use of robots and drones, eventually to remove all human accountability, and it's all done under the guise of national security. So really, you know, we're having a loss of liberty here in the early 21st century, and the reasoning that they give us is terrorism. But the terrorism inquiry, when you try to figure out what's going on with that, it leads you into what I, you know, refer to as America's hidden history, something that's hidden right under our noses, but we're not told about.
Well, there's certainly a lot about our history that's been hidden, that's for sure.
Well, you know, and you can pick kind of any point and start to find it in history, whether it's World War I or Vietnam or any of the things that we've experienced in between. There are all these little nodes that people pick up on that are, you know, seen as anomalies or, you know, the little coincidences or things like this that happen through history. But when you get enough of these dots, a comprehensive picture begins to emerge. And what you notice is that, you know, when we study, for instance, terrorism over the 20th century, first off, you have to deal with this thing called democide, which is death by government. And there was almost 300 million people killed in the 20th century, not during the wars, but directly by their government's actions. So there's that whole question of, you know, what are governments, you know, role, especially in America, that's supposed to serve and protect our rights? What happens when that gets turned on itself? In other words, If our way of life were under attack, what would that look like? Would it look like, you know, the First Amendment and the president has a kill list out there? Would it look like a Second Amendment, you know, there's an attack on people who use firearms and want to be able to protect themselves and not wait for the empire to come and protect them? Would it look like invasion of your privacy like the NSA? So there are these different dynamics that are going on in our country. And when you trace the history of, you know, the strategy of tension and these different games that are being played with America, you really get outside of American history and you're learning world history.
Exactly. You talk about something calling the, I hope I can say it right, panopticon state.
Well, this is an idea. The Panopticon was modeled as a prison. It was a metaphorical prison. It was created by a guy named Jeremy Bentham back in the 1700s for the East India Company. I think it was the early 1800s. And basically what this did was put everyone under surveillance, but you couldn't see who was watching you. So back at the time of conception, this wasn't a very practical idea. They didn't have the resources to carry it out. They did some experiments in Russia, and that's what the Gulag system was. It was the importation of this British idea of a panopticon, and that was, you know, used throughout the 20th century. What you have today, really, in the cybernetic NSA state where everyone's being spied on and our data is being collected, you see this panopticon fully realized where everyone knows they're being watched now, but you don't really know who's watching you. And that puts everyone in a current, you know, constant state of stress and unknown and turmoil. And so when you look at the root cause of what brings that about, that strategy of tension, that brings you back into World War II and something that the Nazis developed, a guy named Otto Skorzeny, who was luckily, you know, for the Americans, you know, taxpaying into this war effort and post-war effort. He's one of these Nazis that's a quote-unquote good Nazi that the CIA and OPC dealt with. And so, you know, when you find out that your tax dollars went to the enemy after the war as an American, I didn't feel too good about that. And so learning about American history and learning about world history, you're really starting to resolve some of these seeming contradictions or coincidences. And you're realizing that the Nazis and the Soviets were funded by Wall Street and Britain, and that the Muslim Brotherhood was also a British terrorist project, started in 1928, that the Cold War was a war of fear unnecessarily waged in order to expand all sides of power, and that things like Al-Qaeda, again, you know, comes from British involvement with the Arab Nazis or Muslim Brotherhood, and that has been used over the 20th century all the way up till today. So really what happens is they fear you being informed, and if you had free time and you were comfortable, you'd be getting informed. So they keep you in this constant state of fear and unknown because they rule by fear and ignorance of the facts. So as long as they can keep us separate from understanding and avoiding the lies, they've pretty much got us all under stimulus reaction control. And that's, you know, that's basically the story of the 20th century moving into the 21st century now.
Well, where do you see the 21st century going? What's their end game?
Well, the end game is to control all the resources on the planet and to have a monopoly, just like they, you know, just like the East India Company had a monopoly on any number of trades. And this whole notion of free trade we can get into in a couple minutes because that's a big idea today, but it's interesting to see what its origins are. What you see in the news today is a reflection of history continuing to repeat because we haven't learned either the tune or the rhyme.
Right. Well, history does certainly continues to repeat. Now, one interesting, well, a lot of what I was listening to on your podcast all points back to the East India Company. And when you try to tell the average American that even our flag is based on the East India Company, they look at you like deer in the headlights.
I would agree. The first flag of the United States is known as the Grand Union flag, and basically it is identical to the East India Company flag, partially because the colonists, not all colonists, but Anglophiles, people who were endeared to the British Empire and the class or caste system of Britain, had been smuggling opium just like the East India Company. So when they changed the flag and tried to become separate from Britain, they also still needed to continue trade in China. So when you went over to a Chinese port like Canton to do opium trading, you wanted a flag that looked like something that they're used to recognizing, but of course could be easily distinguished if you were British. So what you have is a monopoly that's being built, a global monopoly that's being built on slavery and slave trading and opium trading and getting countries addicted to opium and morphine and later heroin, you know. And so you see this ominous continuity from the activities of the East India Company bubbling all the way up through today's history with American troops guarding Afghanistan and making sure that the poppies are being grown and harvested and put on the market. And you've got an ever increasing heroin importation into America. And I can't help but notice that Afghanistan, you know, the British, I had at least two or three wars in Afghanistan in the 1800s going into the 1900s. So this, again, America seems to be on the front end of a longtime British engagement of a strategic area that also has a strategic black market value. which, you know, ties us back into the East India Company, the origins of British intelligence, the drug smuggling, the narco dollars, you know, all the things that our economy is based on, the parallel unknown history of America, because this is really what's running things. And the other thing that we get in school is really a children's story.
Right. And a bad story at that. You know, you talk about, you know, the poppies in Afghanistan, and all of a sudden we supposedly have a heroin, like a heroin epidemic going through the country. Would you say that this is a part of their goal to addict people?
Well, it's a long part of the British history. I mean, that's the history of the Opium Wars in China. For those that don't know, just search East India Company, Opium Wars. But after we had the Boston Tea Party, which was a revolt by the Sons of Liberty, you know, George Washington's first spy ring against the East India Company. That's who owned the tea. So, we have the Boston Tea Party. A couple decades later, the East India Company's on the other side of the world, selling a different part of the leg of travel, you know, because they trade tea and cotton and opium, and it's a globalized sequence of trades that adds up to their monopoly. So the emperor of China dumps like 1,500 tons of opium into the drink. You know, it's their version of the Boston Tea Party. So this is a story that's repeated through history, where basically people who have integrity are asked to do unjust things. And they eventually rise up and they take action against their oppressors. So the fact that we're being spied on today by, you know, everyone knows, you know, these Snowden leaks and this sort of thing, the NSA. But what are the origins of the NSA and why are they spying on us? Well, it goes back to a British intelligence organization called GCHQ. Now, in some of the recent Snowden leaks, you can look at the bottom of the slides in the slideshow, and those slides are created by GCHQ. Which is part of British intelligence, part of the British Empire, part of the British organization of the planet under the power of English-speaking peoples, which when you dig into their goals and their wording on that, it's a racist idea. Kipling referred to it as the white man's burden. And basically in 1898, the British got us to buy off on that same white man's burden. That's the Spanish-American War. And ever since then, America has slowly been amalgamated back into the British Empire, taking on British goals, using British bases around the world. I mean, all these things that we see as un-American that are being done with our Defense Department dollars, if you dig into the history of those events, you can easily see where the British influence came in and said, you guys aren't going to be isolationists and just keep, maintain your borders. You're going to be used as the broadsword so that the other group can graduate and kind of sit in the background and steer the operations.
So did America ever really get independent from Britain?
Well, that could be up for debate depending on how deep you want to dig into it. When you look at the fact that most of our presidents have been related back to British royalty, I would say that's not coincidence. And when you look at, various arguments about the founding fathers, whether or not they were, the British Empire might have said, look, there's going to be a revolution over there. Let's have some of our guys handle it so it never gets out of hand. And if you look at the Treaty of 1783 and what, who has power in that and who loses power and et cetera, it's open for interpretation. But the question that really needs to be asked is, even if we haven't become separate from the British Empire in our past, shouldn't we be separate? Shouldn't we have a government by reason in this country? Because they have a government by hereditary succession and divine right and kings.
Mm-hmm. Well, surely looks like we have the same thing here, even though we call them presidents. Especially when you look at what I'm sure you'll agree, is going to be the next ticket, another Clinton and another Bush.
Well, again, you have, basic forms of hereditary succession. When I was looking at the secretaries of war and the secretaries of state, for instance, how the Dulles family came to power. Well, there's Robert Lansing and then there's John Foster. And when you climb back up the chain, back in history, you see it's a study in nepotism. That it's, father being handed to son or, being handed to the son-in-law or, it's all being kept in the family. And there's a continuity because when you see, that just because we allegedly separated from Britain in 1776, through the revolution, you don't have the whole point is there were people in America called loyalists and they were making money from the opium smuggling and, the whole East India Company racket. Those people never left. And so through the 1800s, you know, you had opium money already having funded Harvard and Yale and some of these other Ivy League schools. So in the 1800s, when Yale brings in this secret society, Skull and Bones, if you actually trace its origin, it's all about opium smuggling through the Russell and Company, which is opium traders participating in the East India Company trade of monopoly and harnessing other populations through addiction. Okay. So people think of it as, oh, it's a German secret society. Well, if you see that also the Germans took over Britain with George the First, that's who George the First is. He comes over and there's a whole line of succession where German royalty transferred and took over the island and then waged war against itself to destroy the other the remaining competition, that being Russia and then Germany in World War One. It's very interesting because it doesn't just limit you to American history when you're trying to understand what's going on to us as humanity.
Well, I did want to ask you, you know, you talked about Ed Snowden, and a lot of people want to say that, you know, he's not legitimate. What's your view of Snowden?
Well, I don't know whether he's legitimate or not, but he's certainly an interesting case study. The fact that when he leaves here to go to China and then he goes to Russia, he still hasn't left any place that the British haven't controlled through spies for the last 100 years. So, you know, one of Britain's first great spies is this guy named Sidney Reilly, and he specifically was sent in to infiltrate Russia, and that was around the time of the Bolshevik Revolution. And then when you check out who financed, you know, Lenin and Stalin and who, you know, helped them with Western aid and what the Dawes plan was to help Germany and all these different things that went on with our taxpayer dollars. So, you know, it's my grandparents' taxpayer dollars. I'm interested in figuring out how it's been used and abused. And you find out that, you know, looking into Snowden, that's a very murky area. I mean, he goes from one murky company, the CIA, over to this other murky company, the NSA, and he's being, you know, held out there by Greenwald, who can't be out of the control of GCHQ because he didn't get disappeared. He did a deal with billionaire Pierre Omidyar. Okay. So I would just recognize that there's been a lot of other legitimate whistleblowers with mind-blowing information who have never seen the light of day in press, let alone be on everyone's, you know, the tip of their tongue.
Would you look at what he revealed as something very huge? Because I think his revelations were huge. It obviously took the world by storm, unless they're just acting like a cover story.
That is an excellent question, and I have an excellent answer that stands up to that. It's a big deal because nobody knew about this. But GCHQ has been spying on America since 1945. Look up Project Shamrock or Project Minaret. Or I happen to have an NSA archive file here from 1955 that talks about this NSA research board. And it says about it's creating exchange research fellowships between the agency, NSA, and GCHQ. And so they're talking about programs that they had already been running in the 40s and 50s and how they could improve these for the 60s and 70s. So, you know, I'd always known about NSA spying on Americans for a long time. That's not really news. What the news is for people to actually put together what is GCHQ. It's the father of MI6 and MI5. It's many times bigger, just like the NSA is many times bigger than the CIA.
Well, a lot of people would say, you know, well, why would Britain want to spy on Americans?
Well, you know, as Americans, we were like, you know, we fought the revolution and then we thought we were a free country. Britain's an empire. And, Britain is a country. There's a great book called All the Countries We've Ever Invaded and a Few We Never Got Around To by an Englishman named Stuart Laycock. And in there, he shows you historically that the British have invaded all but like 10 countries on this planet at one time or another. And so the empire, you know, it's always listening. That's GCHQ. And it never forgets. It didn't forget that we snubbed it and tried to become free. It was continually trying to recolonize us. And there's several instances through history starting, you know, basically after the War of 1812, where they start hypothesizing how to make America part of the British Empire again. You can see this, there's Churchill during World War II. Specifically has this quote where he's, you know, seeking to make Americans and British joint citizens. And then there was a Cecil Rhodes project called Union Now, which was under the guise of world federalism, of which you had participants like Walter Cronkite. Look up Walter Cronkite and world federalism and cross-reference that with Clarence Street, the Rhodes scholar who wrote Union Now, joining America with Britain. So you have that's the 1900s. In the 1800s, you've got Andrew Carnegie calling for it. You've got Cecil Rhodes calling for it. You've got all these other people. So they basically had resources. They got a plan together. They brought in the Federal Reserve, the CFR, and these other think tanks that were basically meant to turn America's behaviors, attitudes, values in favor of Britain. That, you know, just because we're allies, they kind of make it look like we're best friends forever. And that we should just open up all of our secrets and all of our intelligence and all of our plans and make it transparent back through the Joint Intelligence Committee, up through GCHQ, up through, you know, whoever else is behind the Queen, the bankers, you know.
Well, do you think that the British Empire is as strong today as it used to be? Do you think it's above or in strength the United States?
I think it's much stronger than it used to be, because prior to World War One, they knew if they lost naval supremacy that they would lose everything. And so they had to figure out how to get us into the war, how to keep us in the war, how to change our attitudes and values in this country. And all the way up through today, where you've got Princeton came out with a paper last week that said the United States is an oligarchy. And I happen to have that document right here. Let me read to you from its summary. It says, what do our findings say about democracy in America? They certainly constitute troubling news for advocates of populistic democracy who want governments to respond primarily or exclusively to the policy preferences of their citizens. In the United States, our findings indicate the majority does not rule, at least in the causal sense of actually determining policy outcomes. When a majority of citizens disagrees with economic elites and or organized interests, they generally lose. Moreover, because of the strong status quo bias built in the U.S. political system, even when fairly large majorities of Americans favor policy change, they generally do not get it.
Well, that's the truth of it.
That's the truth. And that's the British system right there. That's the British system.
Yeah, and it's funny because all these years, whenever I see a news story of especially suppression and spying in the UK, I've always said it'll soon happen in the United States. If it's happening in England, it'll soon happen here.
Right.
And it always does.
Right. And I think it's also very important for individuals to keep separate the ideas of our government versus the people. Like when I'm talking about the British form of government, I'm not talking about the people in Britain. I'm not talking about the individual people just like us who live all over the planet and happen to live on other sides of imaginary lines. I'm talking about the systematic corruption of reality and saying that a pragmatic truth, whatever strong people say it is better than objective truth. And that's the difference really between the American system that's based on objective reality and therefore natural rights, and the British system that's based on the divine right of kings and therefore a bunch of imaginary superstition that says someone else has the right to make you their slave.
Right. Well, it's obvious that, you know, Great Britain was involved in the slave trade forever. It was probably their idea.
Well, they learned it from other countries. It's just like, you know, they're kind of, when you read through the history, it's like, well, Britain came in late in the game with the East India Company, but they obviously learned all that was going on and then improved upon it and then monopolized it and then put all these other places out of business. And they've done that successively in a bunch of different areas. So that's why it's fascinating to learn our history.
Right. Well, you know, when you look at, you know, the next setup, which appears to be the Ukraine, and supposedly our allies, you know, Johnny on the spot to jump in and create, you know, a bigger problem than it already is. You got to wonder now, you know, especially after talking with you and listening to your podcast, you know, how much of this is England creating?
Well, that's a great question. Go to your favorite internet search engine, type in the Crimean War, and see what kind of activity Britain's had over there for a couple hundred years. And then when you take into account, it's like, who are we fighting? You know, who are they fighting? Because I'm not their ally. They want to fight Russia. Well, who's Russia? Russia used to be the Soviet Union. Well, who's the Soviet Union? It's a place that was financed by the Wall Street and British financiers. You know, and the other thing to keep in mind is that government is the mechanism through which money becomes power. So whether you're talking about Nazism or communism or socialism or any of these isms out there, bankers are behind all of that, making it work. And they are international. They don't have any sort of, you know, allegiance to a certain place on this planet because they want to take it all. You know, their thinking is everything or nothing. And so, you know, that's what we're dealing with right now.
Right. Well, you know, right now we have Venezuela, and I think, you know, Bolivia, I want to think, just kicked our diplomats out. But you have Venezuela screaming that the United States is trying to go in there on a coup and steal their resources. So is it really the United States, or are we fighting England's wars?
Okay, well, again, if you want to talk about Central America, I would say let's do a little research on this guy I call Nelly Rock, also called Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller. In the 1940s and 50s, he's in charge of psychological warfare in something called the CIAA, the Center for Inter-American, you know, screwing with other countries, basically, in Latin America. It's the financing of propaganda, highly refined propaganda, where they own all the newspapers, radio stations, theaters, and they're just propagandizing everybody under the guise of anti-communism, because if we don't do it, the communists are going to take over. Well, Nelson Rockefeller is also involved in funding the communists, and his whole family is, you know, so you've got people doing these things in the name of protecting you from XYZ, while their families are also involved in creating the other side of it, which is where we started this conversation.
Right. So for them, it's a win-win. You know, you opened up your podcast with a secret recording of Donald Rumsfeld talking about false flags. And, you know, I can remember him, you know, it's not, you know, a matter of if, it's a matter of when. How many times have we heard that line from different politicians since? Well, so I would assume he too, like everybody in office in D.C., are, you know, on the dole of this one world disorder by the East India Company.
In the post 9/11 world, they're saying we have to do all this awful stuff to degrade your civil and human rights because of terrorism. And yet, when you look at who's behind the terrorism historically, I mean, for instance, there's a recent book called The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terror. And in the 21st century, of 22, you know, so-called terrorist events, that this guy, the author, who's a journalist, could prove that the FBI staged 14 of those 22. And I argued that the other, you know, the other couple, you'll figure that out too. It's like they have to do these threats to increase and maintain their budgets. But in the absence of waiting for, you know, random threats to build up and legitimately, you know, be there, they have a factory that creates them artificially by controlling all these informants. And this goes back to World War II techniques of double and triple agents and employing Nazis after the war and, you know, creating stay behind units and this, all this British policy that basically, again, got put into America through the creation of our intelligence agencies coming from British intelligence agencies.
Right. Well, not only that, I'm sure they also have their hand in Hollywood. You know, it's not just newspapers. And, you know, we do seem to have the same kind of right, you know, right by blood in Hollywood. Look at how many people in Hollywood, you know, their children become movie stars. Their grandchildren become movie stars. It's like we get the same names thrown at us even there. I'm sure that's not an accident.
Well, let's look at there's a recent movie star they call Armie Hammer. Well, his grandfather, or maybe it was great-grandfather, was Armand Hammer, who was chairman of the Communist Party USA and a big communist financier. And Armand Hammer baking soda is, you know, is a play on his name. And Edward J. Epstein wrote a whole book on Armand Hammer and his connections into it. And so when you figure out who that is, then you can also find where Al Gore's lineage comes from, because his father and grandfather did work for the, you know, the communists, you know, and the same oil people that were developing Russia. So his whole family's money comes from Occidental Petroleum, which is Western Petroleum. You know, so when you see him doing the global warming stuff, it's really ironic. That's what I'm saying. We have an irony deficiency disorder because we lack the history to recognize. And so we're like a laughingstock. When you read any of the books from the British side on World War II or some of these activities that go on here in America that we think we know about, it's like they're laughing at us because we are so easy to dupe. I mean, I can't even I would have to do a whole show just on their commentary on how easy we are to dupe. But there is one quote that sticks with me. It says, in the first half of the century, the British intelligence was principally a machine for involving the United States in a war on the British side. The relative underdevelopment of American espionage made this a simple enough task when coordinated with the right social and political strata. And that comes from an Oxford historian known as Christopher Hitchens in a book called Blood, Class, and Nostalgia, Anglo-American Ironies.
Hmm. Pretty damn interesting. Rich, we're going to take a short break, and I'm going to ask the audience, of course, to stay with us. When we come back, first question I'm going to ask you is, what is an Anglophile? So stay with us. Rich and I will be right back. Okay, welcome back to Tragedy and Hope with myself and my co-host, Richard Groves. Get over to his site, tragedyandhope.com. Rich has got a world of information on that site, and please make sure to make a donation because none of us are getting rich on this. Truth, like I say, truth selling doesn't generally pay off too well. Rich, before the break, I asked you a question. What is an Anglophile? I mean, as an Italian, I can remember as far back as my grandparents, you know, where they would talk about Anglos, but we had a different view of Anglos because, you know, don't forget, real history, when Italians came to this country, we were classified non-white, and we knew we weren't white. So it was, even as a kid, I remember trying very hard to assimilate, to be a white kid in America, even if it meant eating peanut butter, which I detested as a kid. But we had our own view of what Anglos were. Now you're talking about an Anglophile. So what is it? What's the difference?
Well, first I want to say that I think it's sad that this theme of racism has run such a course in America. It used to be known as racialism, and then H.G. Wells coined it in, I think, 1938 as racism in one of his books. So, you know, it's always the divide and conquer mentality based on, oh, you've got more melanin in your skin than me or whatever. And so traditionally, the word Anglo refers to England. So anytime you hear Anglo, just think England or English or the divine right of kings in action today, you know, this sort of thing. So Anglophiles are people who believe that we're not fit to rule ourselves, that they should be part of a caste system of lords and earls and, you know, duchesses and this whole sort of Holy Roman Empire idea. So Anglophiles are people who live in America or elsewhere who worship that Holy Roman Empire system of a caste system with masters and slaves. So Anglophiles, in my terminology, historically, you know, referring to America, these are people like Andrew Carnegie or Rockefeller or J.P. Morgan or any of these people whose allegiances are international back to the Holy Roman Empire and their financiers and have nothing to do with the founding ideas of America, which, again, it could have been improved upon at the time, but it was a good start, and I think we should continue to realize and use reason in governing ourselves and thus and not infringing the rights of others. And that means some of those things becomes obsolete.
Right. So how did they try to Anglify America?
Well, it's been, like I said, it's been an ongoing development since they lost the War of 1812, since they burned the White House and seemingly went away. But really what they did is, you know, the British, there's a famous quote where it says the British never win peace, that they always buy it. And that, you know, basically the way that they got peace was they started to buy into America. So you see increasing investment from British and foreign bankers pre-Civil War that have interests in catalyzing the Civil War to have America collapse on itself so it could be taken back over by the British Empire. And these are still in the days of the East India Company. But the East India Company weren't, you know, it basically became amalgamated into the empire. And then the empire went from being overt to covert in the 20th century. So they called themselves a commonwealth, and they tried to speak of themselves, from Churchill's own words, in terms that ameliorate the English to the American way of system. So, you know, so we would see ourselves as their cousins, and we would share all our information, and, you know, so we had this special relationship. Well, that special relationship has gotten America in some deep trouble, because basically that is the root cause of our foreign policy, of our educational changes, all the things that have gone on in the 20th century, where we see ourselves being dumbed down generation after generation by a very cunning and slow-moving incremental system of changes that are really hard to recognize at any given time. So you have to look at longer stretches of time to pick up on it. But the whole creation and importation of something like the Prussian education system is not something that was unwanted by the British. It's something that very much helped them take control and easily manipulate the minds and actions of Americans.
Well, I have to tell you, it looks like they've done a good job. You know, I could think about, you know, let's just talk about when one of their princes or get married, you know, how everybody in America gets so involved and they're, you know, all anxious to watch it on TV and buy souvenirs and whatnot. almost like we still want to believe in fairy tales.
Well, and that's the extended adolescence that they've sought to create in the American public. Give us bread and circuses. Get us to watch, you know, people turn left for 500 rounds, you know, trips around the racetrack and call that a sport. You know, get your favorite jersey and go watch all these teams and don't actually learn about what's going on in the world or what happened before you got here. And if you don't do that, you're not going to be able to participate. And so by, you know, the bread and circus tactic, they're taking people out of the game, making them spectators to their own lives. And that's slavery. That's slavery. But they've got you to, like, willingly do it and pay for it. And, you know, so it's an advanced form of warfare. Yeah, it's an advanced. Well, this is what Huxley was also talking about in The Ultimate Revolution and making you love your servitude. That they could, they were creating a terrarium environment that wasn't reality. It's not nature. It's something artificially created by man through which they can make you love your servitude. That's the panopticon.
Well, you know, wasn't Huxley an insider? You know, he couldn't have written Brave New World, which certainly looks like today, if he wasn't an insider. He couldn't have been a psychic, not that good a psychic.
I mean, I don't even think of him as an insider. I think of him as one of the architects, because look at his family lineage. You've got Malthus working for the East India Company. You've got Adam Smith working for the East India Company, coming up with, you know, Wealth of Nations, which is about how to increase your opium production, et cetera, et cetera. I'm being somewhat sarcastic there, but that's really what he's talking about when he's talking about produce. He's talking about the opium poppy. So you've got all these British ideas. Malthus was East India Company. And then leading up to Darwin, Darwin's most enthusiastic supporter was a guy named T.H. Huxley. He was known as Darwin's Bulldog. He tutored H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells tutored Aldous Huxley. Aldous Huxley tutored George Orwell. So you have, again, this continuity of people who, you know, propagate psychological warfare on behalf of the British crown, coming to Orwell, where he's basically somewhat a whistleblower. He's working on the inside in the place where they're doing all this psychological warfare at that time. So he's painting it in the future. But really what he's showing to America is Orwell's boss was this guy named Brendan Bracken, BB, or they called him Big Brother. And the whole idea was to change the, you know, because when you get down to it, the opposition speaks the same language as we do. So there we're manipulating our language, removing words that contain freedom, the whole telescreen and, or, you know, and you know, Winston Smith being spied on. Like that's what's going on today with GCHQ. It was going on then with GCHQ. And this is what Orwell's telling you through this veiled story. Right. And so it's a fascinating history, you know, between Orwell's transition to say, look, some of this isn't so cool. And, you know, whereas his teacher kind of disagreed with him. And Huxley's like, look, you know, it could all be bright and rosy because we give people these psychedelics and they don't know they're being controlled. Whereas Orwell's like, look, when you're aware that you're being controlled, it's a totally different situation. And, you know, that was going on in 1948.
Mm-hmm. Well, you look at Americans today and they're being controlled every which way but loose. Do you think that we have the gumption or the spirit to break free of it?
I do think, and I do think that we have the spirit to break free of it, because the reason that Great Britain as a empire system that takes away people's rights and kind of plunders their liberty has survived is because they encountered a bunch of other places that weren't as advanced. But during the 19th century, America really
you know, one of the more fascinating stories, you know, it clicked instantly with me when I was listening to your podcast, was how the Brits basically bought property here, brought the slaves over here on our cotton plantations, and then how pretty much they shipped most of that cotton out of our country anyway and traded it for opium.
Well, and they financed the Confederacy, and you know, so there was, and then they took away their financing from the Confederacy after Gettysburg. So, you know, there's this again. It's partially we're easily controlled because we're not putting our thinking and learning in between stimulus and response. So, can you blame an empire that's learned that if you can make people fearful and thus in a stimulus response mindset, they're easy to control? It's like if people aren't willing to learn their way out of it. You know, there's, you know, what are you going to do? But I think that's what America's, you know, when I say that they haven't been successful yet, because they don't understand what makes America America. You can't understand America from the mindset that supports the divine and right of kings. And so I'm saying they're trying to snuff out a candle that they don't understand how the flame works, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so
right.
That's our advantage because they, you know, it's been extinguished a lot of places, freedom in this country, but I think a lot of people still remember what it looks and smells and feels like, and we seek to try to preserve that for generations in the future because the plans of the internationalists are it's going to be robots and drones and smart weapons between you and them, and it's going to be like Elysium. I mean, those are realistic pictures of what they say in their own plans.
I mean, absolutely. Even that movie Divergent, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but it's right in your face how they intend to split us up into class. And anybody that's a free thinker, it's open season.
Well, and there's a document, if you're near a search engine, you can type in DC Strategic Trends 2007 to 2036. And there's a British Ministry of Defense document that paints out the next, you know, couple decades. And it's you can see where it's come from because we're 7 years past 2007 now. So you can see some of this stuff coming into our culture. And without somebody saying that plan exists and here's how we're not going to have that happen, they're going to have it, you know, reach a summit. They're going to get what they want because people don't even know to resist because they don't know what's going on.
Exactly. And yet they kind of put it in our face in a subliminal way, especially through movies.
Yeah.
But, you know, most people look at a movie and just see it as entertainment and go home. You know, I look at it and I go into shock. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, holy shit, this is exactly what they're planning. So education, of course, is key, which is why you and I do what we do. But, you know, we can't force anybody to listen. When I was a young girl, one of my favorite writers was Ian Fleming. I have to say I probably read every James Bond book as soon as it was hot off the presses. But in those days, of course, to us, it was fantasy. Like the first gold, you know, the first James Bond movie, I think, was Goldfinger. You know, to us, it was fantasy. But after a little bit of investigation and listening to your podcast, there was nothing fantasy about it.
Yeah, isn't that a shame that there's – I mean, first, I would just make this observation that Americans specifically are addicted to entertainment because we're starving for real knowledge. Now, they'll show us the James Bond films, all 40 of them or whatever, and they'll show them on TV. And, you know, here's this thing that ameliorates America and Britain. CIA is always supporting James Bond, and they're on the same side. And, you know, James Bond's always in America operating. That's a British spy on American soil operating, which is what Ian Fleming was. He was a British spy operating on American soil, among other things in his career. He was asked by Donovan to draw up a 70-page document, which was the blueprints for the OSS and later the CIA. So I came into contact with Ian Fleming's actual history, and I was like, this can't be true. And then I dug a little bit deeper, and then I'm like, it's worse. And then I started looking into, you know, who his bosses were and what this, you know, some of these different groups were. And then I started to notice some of the names come up, you know, again and again. And I said, are there any of these guys who worked on the James Bond films? And sure enough, when you build out, you know, who is Ken Adams and who is and some of these other guys that, you know, they're spies. They're British spies who worked with Ian Fleming in this thing called the British Special Operations Executive, which did espionage, sabotage, blowing stuff up, poisoning people, you know, assassinations, what have you. They were like Churchill's dirty trick squad or Churchill's secret army. Think of them like that. And so it's a bunch of charismatic guys that they have carte blanche access and all the money they need. And so Fleming didn't have to be creative at all when he so-called retired and exposed American audiences to all that propaganda called a PSYOP. You know, so what I'm saying is if you're starving for information or starving for knowledge, it's not because it's not out there. It's because it's not being advertised to us. And so take your mind off the entertainment and start looking into what's behind all this entertainment. And it's much more fascinating because it's a story that's going on and you're in it.
Right. Like
you're not watching it. You're in this.
Exactly. It could be more entertaining than reality once you understand what reality
is.
Well,
yeah. If you think Spectre is scary from watching James Bond films, then look up Operation Gladio and realize that the people that created Gladio are the special operations executive for which Ian Fleming worked. And now you're like, holy shit, he's describing something that's real.
Well, yeah, I'm sure all of it, you know, all of it ties in together. It's just, you know, it just reminds me of Alice in Wonderland. It's like the deeper you go down the hole, the more you realize there's no bottom.
Well, there's no bottom to history, but there is an exit to the rabbit hole. and the exit, you know, the reason you go down the rabbit hole is because you're exposed to information and you can't tell up from down, black from white. You can't tell fact from fiction, which is the whole spy world that they create through, you know, intelligence, counterintelligence, espionage, counterespionage, spy hunting, spy tracking, all these different things where they're trying to deceive each other. And then national security obscures all the truth from everybody. And you get some, you know, watered down, redacted story that's all whited out as your version of history, right? But,
right.
You know, so the exit of the rabbit hole is to actually, you know, grab onto reality, start to find the quotes, organize the dots, find the credible, you know, evidence that does exist, because you don't have to know every detail. You just need to know the broad strokes of the ongoing plan to take away your individual liberty. That won't go away. It's not going to go away in our lifetimes, but we could certainly, you know, shift the scales here.
Right. Well, you know, this is also something for people to think about. That basically 95% of what Ian Fleming wrote about James Bond was true. It was a diary.
Well, he says in the, it's a book on the British Security Coordination, which was the British insertion of spies into Rockefeller Center and making it part of our intelligence network. He says in there that, you know, Bond is not a hero, that James Bond is a blunt instrument. That is he's basically the glamorous part that he shows you. He's like, but the really interesting part are the people that run the spies of which he was a part. You know, he's a spy master, and the people he's writing about, you know, M in the movies, the guy who's always giving Bond his orders, is an actual, you know, several people that it's a composite of. And when you look at all the spies that James Bond is composited off of, you're learning about the real history and the real spies and the real people that risk their lives. You know, sometimes for questionable causes, because, war is not what we're taught it is, you know, so war is being used as an instrument, as the end of political shenanigans and, you know, just basically saying at the tip of a sword or end of a missile, here's what we want and you're going to give it to us. You know, it's about a monopoly on force, which gets back to the topic of government and the difference between the divine right of kings and a reason-based government where we interact with each other as equal human beings that don't have any special superpowers.
Right. Well, that's long over in America, as far as I could say.
Well, it's only over as long as people worship, you know, money as their god. You know, if your godhead is money, well, that's an international godhead. First off, it has no boundaries, so you better watch out because that's not very American. If you have, you know, any of these other ideas, like, you know, the president is the ruling authority, or, you know, some book is your ruling authority. I prefer to just apply reason and, you know, look at these situations as a human being and, you know, see what the right and wrong thing is to do and choose the right thing.
So what is the right thing?
The right thing
just
is
for the regular guy, the regular people like you and me, and I'm sure millions of, you know, nice, normal people across the country.
All right.
And the world, what is the right thing? You know, some people say non-participation is key.
Well, I would say the right thing to do is don't take actions that take away other people's rights. And that would mean really like list all the put all the metaphorical titles that you call yourself, Republican, Democrat, Christian, Muslim, you know, all these little titles, put them on your metaphorical desk and wipe them all away. And before you put anything back on, study the full history of that which you are calling yourself a part of, because much of how evil is prevailing on this planet right now is because you got a bunch of people who join groups that they don't know what the origin or the motivations or the actual actions of that group are. And thus, it's easy to divide and conquer everybody when we're all in large groups. It's hard to divide and conquer everyone when everyone's a unique thinking individual who has compassion and empathy and at the same time says, I have certain rights and you're not going to go past this line, or otherwise I'm going to defend myself.
Right. Well, I always tell people, you know, every time a new law is passed, another right is lost.
Well, and who gave that person the right to make laws over other people? How did that, you know, I don't have the right to do that. You don't have the right to do that. I didn't elect that person. How are they making rights over, you know, over laws over what I'm doing? How did someone who was born 100 years ago have the right to tell me what to do today? They're not here anymore. And it's not based on logic or reason, so it's not eternal. You know,
right.
So we inherit. That's the other thing. It's like we participate in all these little schemes and scams and forms and, you know, requests and submissions and all these little things that we do in our life. And you're giving away your power every time you participate and take action in something you don't understand. Because the people who got here before us set up these clever little pitfalls and traps and Ponzi schemes, and they'll talk it up and they'll tell you it's real. And I'm just saying, you know, do some looking for yourself, because it's your life and you're the one who has to live it. And there's plenty of people already set up. You know, the British didn't invent all this stuff. They got it from the Venetians, and the Venetians got it from someone before them. And I can go through the whole history. The point is, it's the story of history of people using lies to take other people's power. And the only way you can escape that is to learn how to tell fact from fiction on a consistent basis. And the only way to do that is to observe, identify that which exists, remove the contradictions, and communicate with other people to find out how much you've learned.
Exactly. Which is, I would say, goes back to, you know, you and I had a discussion yesterday of why we do what we do. And I know that there are a lot of other people that are also free thinkers that also want the truth. So, you know, the day you stop doing what you do, the day I stop doing what I do, then I think it all is lost, all is lost. But there are a lot of people out there that are doing the right thing to bring that information to people. And it's, you know, you do it tirelessly. I mean, I look at just the size of your podcast and I'm like, holy crap. He does like a month in one podcast. And I know how hard that is. So why do you do it? Are you just being a good patriot?
I do it because, you know, what I'm creating is something that I wish somebody before I got here would have created, and everyone would have already known about this stuff, and we would be able to, you know, live in a world that's non-contradictory and thus pretty much happy for, you know, a lot more people, and at least the people who aren't happy have a chance to get there. You know, they've taken away our opportunity by taking away the knowledge that we need to make informed decisions in our lives and, you know, to be able to help our family and friends. And
absolutely.
So, if you think we're under attack from terrorism and you think the best thing to do is send your son and daughter into the military to go fight a war that, you know, you have no idea why people are funding it, what the underlying agenda is going on. You know, read War is a Racket. Check out Smedley Butler. You know, these are the resources that are out there that it's just like every time some, you know, there are plenty of, there's like 20 soldiers every day that are committing suicide. There's more soldiers dying from suicide than in battle. In other words, we've been at war for since, you know, 2001. And, you know, when you look at covert wars, we've been at war for like 100 years. This is unnecessary, but it's going to continue to repeat until individuals take it upon themselves to program themselves with truth and facts and to resist, you know, the illusions and lies that are out there. And if you're not doing that actively, you're actively being predictively programmed by people who are creating all that fancy entertainment that everyone's so addicted to.
Well, Rich, thank you so much for joining me today. It's always like a classroom for sure. And I look forward to our next session.
Well, thank you, Maria. And thank you to your listeners for helping you provide a forum such that we could speak uninterrupted. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. I treasure every last one of them. I'll talk with you soon, Rich.
All right.
Take care. Richard Grove.